Welcome to Base by Base. We're here to really get into the details of some fascinating science.
That's the plan, taking complex research and breaking it down.
And today we're looking at Marfan syndrome. Now, you might know it as a genetic condition affecting connective tissue, but finding the precise genetic cause, well, that's not always simple.
No, it really isn't. Even when someone clearly has the clinical signs, the standard genetic tests sometimes come back, well, empty. The answer can be hidden.
Hidden somewhere, standard tests just don't look. And that's exactly what a recent paper tackles. It's research led by Susan Walker and her colleagues, published in Genetics and Medicine just this year, 2025.
Right. And their work really dives deep into Marfan, hunting for those genetic changes that have been missed. Our goal here is to walk through their study, understand their methods, the results, what it all means.
We want to see how using things like whole genome sequencing, reading the entire DNA instruction book, not just the main chapters, plus some smart computer analysis and, crucially, lab work, can uncover these hidden genetic causes, specifically variants that mess up something called splicing.
Exactly. Splicing is a key process we'll definitely get into.
Okay, let's start with the basics. Marfan syndrome, MFS. It's a connective tissue disorder, affects maybe 2 or 3 people in every 10,000.
And while it can be diagnosed at different ages, it often becomes apparent in the late teens or early 20s. Connective tissue is, you know, everywhere in the body is the glue, the framework.
So if that's faulty, it can cause problems all over. People might be tall, have long limbs, maybe eye issues.
Yes, those are common features. But the really serious concern, the life-threatening part, is often the aorta, the big artery coming from the heart. It can weaken and stretch, leading to what's called familial thoracic aortic aneurysm disease, or FTTA.
And that can lead to a tear, a dissection.
Precisely, which is incredibly dangerous. That aortic risk is why getting an accurate diagnosis is so vital. Doctors use clinical criteria, the Gent and nosology, to assess the signs.
Now, genetically, we've known for a while that the main player is a gene called FBN1.
Right, FBN1. It's a big gene, huge, actually. Over 237,000 DNA letters broken into 66 exons, which are the bits that code for the protein.
And that protein is fibrillin-1, part of that connective tissue scaffolding we mentioned.
Exactly. Fibrillin-1 is crucial for the extracellular matrix. So if the FBN1 gene has a typo, the instructions for building that scaffolding are wrong.
Makes sense. And we know lots of different types of typos or variants in FBN1 can cause Marfan, things that stop the protein being made too early, small insertions or deletions, single letter changes.
Especially changes affecting specific building blocks called cysteines, which are really important for the protein's shape. Mm. And interestingly, different changes in FBN1 can sometimes cause related but distinct conditions too, not just classic Marfan, like Jaleophysic dysplasia.
So it's complex, but here's the puzzle. Even with good FBN1 testing, over 90% of people with clear clinical Marfan get a genetic diagnosis, but there's still that remaining group, maybe 5-10%, where the tests are negative.
Yeah, and these families are often on what the paper calls a long diagnostic odyssey. They know something is wrong, often affecting multiple family members, but the standard genetic tests don't provide an answer.
Why not? What are the possibilities?
Well, maybe the clinical picture isn't quite Marfan. Maybe it's another gene altogether. But a big reason, and the focus here, is these cryptic variants within the FBN1 gene itself, variants that hide from standard tests.
Cryptic variants, we hear that term. Sometimes it means big rearrangements, but this paper is focused on something else, right? Cryptic splice variants.
Exactly. These are often small changes like single letter swaps, but the key is where they are. They're not in the exons, the coding bits, and crucially, they're not in the tiny bit of intron, the non-coding stuff right next to the exons that tests usually check, maybe the first 8 letters or so.
They're buried deeper in those long intron stretches.
Precisely. Deep intronic variants, or sometimes in other regulatory regions. And standard tests, which focus on exons and those miniate flanking bases, just fly right over them. They don't see them.
And what do these variants do? You mentioned splicing.
Right. So think of splicing as the cell's film editor. The gene gets copied into a long RNA molecule, including both the exons, the scenes you want, and the introns, the bits you don't. Splicing cuts out the introns and stitches the exons together perfectly to make the final Moody script, the mRNA that tells the cell how to build the protein.
Okay, the editing process.
Yeah, and a cryptic splice variant acts like a bad edit instruction. It might create a new, wrong place to cut or join or hide the correct place. It messes up the editing, leading to a garbled mRNA script and usually a protein that doesn't work properly.
So Walker and colleagues set out to systematically figure out how common this problem is, these hidden splice variants causing Marfan or FTA in those undiagnosed cases.
They leveraged a fantastic resource, the UK's 100,000 Genomes Project, the 100 KGP.
Ah, yes, that massive project using whole genome sequencing for rare diseases.
Exactly. It was designed specifically for situations like this, families with suspected genetic conditions, but no answer from standard tests. They looked at genome data from a huge number of people in the project.
How many people?
Their initial analysis used aggregated data from over 78,000 individuals. And critically, within that group, there were over 700 people recruited because they had FTAD, that thoracic aortic disease often linked to Marfan. FTAD was actually one of the more common reasons people joined the rare disease part of the 100 kilo GP.
So they had a large group with the key clinical feature and a very large comparison group. What was the strategy?
They systematically scanned the FBN1 gene in everyone, looking for ultra-rare variants. Initially, they focused only on singleton's variants seen just once in that entire data set of nearly 80,000 people. The idea being that such rare changes are more likely to cause a rare disease.
And how do they know which of those rare variants might affect splicing? They used a tool called Splice AI?
Yes, Splice AI was key. It's a computational tool, a type of AI, really. It's been trained on vast amounts of genetic data to predict how likely any given DNA change is to mess up splicing.
How does it work? What does it tell you?
You feed it the variant, and it looks at the DNA sequence around it. Then it gives you scores from 0 to 1. A high score suggests a high probability that the variant will either create a new splice site where there shouldn't be one gain or break an existing normal one, loss. It predicts different types of splice site changes.
Okay, so find the ultra-rare variants, run them through Splice AI, and then see, do the ones predicted to affect splicing show up more often in the FTA group?
That's exactly the question. Is there an enrichment? If those predicted splice variants are significantly more common in people with FTA, that's strong evidence they're actually contributing to the disease.
So what did they find in that first big scan?
Okay, get this. Across those 78,000 genomes, they found almost 14,000 different ultra-rare singleton variants just within the FBN1 gene sequence.
14,000 in one gene. Wow, that's a lot of rare variation.
It really highlights how much variation exists between individuals. But here's where Splice AI comes in. Out of those nearly 14,000 variants, only 21 had a Splice AI score, suggesting a potentially moderate to strong impact on splicing. They used a cutoff of 0.5 or higher initially.
Just 21 candidates flagged out of 14,000. That really narrows it down. And where did those 21 turn up?
This was the crucial finding. They looked at the frequency. In the 703 individuals recruited with FDAID, 9 of them carried one of these 21 potential splice variants. That's about 1.3% of the FT group.
Okay. And in the others, the big comparison group.
In the over 77,000 people without an FTAID recruitment diagnosis, only 12 individuals had one of these variants.
Yeah.
That's an incidence of just 0.015%.
Right. So 1.3% versus 0.015%. That sounds quite different.
It's hugely different. Statistically, the odds ratio was 84. That means someone in the FTA group was 84 times more likely to carry one of these predicted splice variants than someone in the comparison group. And the p-value was incredibly small, 9.7 times 10 to the minus 14, meaning this association was extremely unlikely to be due to random chance.
An odds ratio of 84. Yeah, that's a really powerful signal telling you these variants are strongly linked to the disease.
Absolutely. It's strong statistical evidence.
Did they look at different Splice AI cutoffs? Because 0.5 is just one choice.
They did. And that's important. As you change the threshold, you change the balance. A higher threshold, like 0.8, is stricter. You catch fewer variants, only 10 here, but a higher proportion of them were in the FTAD cases, 7 out of 10. A lower threshold, like 0.3, is more sensitive. It catches more potential variants, 34, including 11 in the FTAD group. The enrichment was significant across different thresholds. But exploring this helps understand the trade-offs between finding more potential hits versus getting fewer false positives.
And did they also look at variants that weren't quite so rare, not just singletons?
Briefly, yes. They relaxed the criteria slightly to include variants seen up to 5 times. They still found significant enrichment in the FTAD group, but the odds ratio was lower, around 35. Which makes sense. Slightly more common variants are less likely to be the sole cause of a rare disease.
Okay, so that initial scan gave really strong statistical backing, but they wanted to find more families, right? to maximize the diagnostic potential.
Exactly. So they did a secondary analysis focusing just on the full set of families recruited into the 100 QDP rare disease program specifically for FDAY. This let them include families missed in the first aggregated data set, maybe due to data access timing or using older genome references. This focus cohort included 672 families with FDAY.
And they tweaked their search strategy for this deeper dive.
Yeah, they broadened the net a bit. They didn't restrict it to only singleton variants anymore. They allowed variants with a frequency up to 0.1% in the population. Mm-hmm. They also used a slightly lower splice AI threshold of 0.2 to be more sensitive. And they pulled in data from families analyzed earlier, plus one family identified through routine clinical testing using similar software.
What did this more targeted, wider search turn up?
It was successful. This secondary analysis identified another 14 families who had candidate FBN1 splice variants meeting these criteria. There were 11 different variants found across these 14 families.
So put it all together, the initial scan, this secondary analysis, What's the final count?
In total, combining all phases and including a few known variants from previous reports in these cohorts, they identified 20 unique candidate splice variants. These were found in 32 individuals across 23 different families, all previously lacking a genetic diagnosis despite having features of MARFN or FTED.
23 families getting a potential genetic answer they didn't have before? That's really impactful. Where did these 20 variants actually occur in the FBN1 gene?
They were pretty spread out, located in introns ranging from intron 1 right near the start of the gene all the way out to intron 63 near the end. There wasn't one single major hotspot, although a couple of introns did have variants found in more than one family.
And the key question, were they mostly in those cryptic regions?
Yes. This really validated the whole approach. Of the 20 unique variants identified, 14 of them, so 70% were located outside the standard plus minus 8 base pair region around the exons that typical tests analyze. They were indeed deep intronic variants, confirming they would have been missed by conventional sequencing.
Okay. And what did SpliceAI predict these 20 variants would actually do to the splicing process?
There were a few different predicted outcomes. The most common, seen for 9 of the 20 variants, was something called pseudo-exonization.
Pseudo-exonization, creating a fake exon, like adding a scene that doesn't belong.
That's a great analogy. The variant creates splicing signals within an intron that trick the cell's machinery into including a chunk of that intron sequence in the final mRNA message, as if it were a real exon. This inserts junk information, basically, and almost always messes up the resulting protein.
What else did SpliceAI predict?
Exon extension was also common, predicted for another 9 variants. This is where the normal splice site is ignored, and a cryptic site further into the intron is used instead, making the adjacent exon longer than it should be. One of these even affected the non-coding 5' UTR region at the start.
And less common predictions.
They saw one predicted case of exon skipping where a whole real exon is just left out, and one case of exon contraction where only part of a real exon is included. Interestingly, none of the variants they found in this set were standard coding variants that also happened to affect splicing. These are primarily variants disrupting splicing from within the non-coding regions.
Now, predicting this with a computer is one thing, but you really need to prove it happens in the cell, right? Experimental validation.
Absolutely critical. You can't just rely on the prediction, especially for clinical diagnoses. You need to show that the variant actually causes abnormal splicing in patient cells or a model system.
How did they try to validate these predictions? They looked at RNA sequencing data.
They did. RNA-seq data was available for 10 of the 23 families. RNA-seq basically reads out all the RNA messages in a cell sample.
And did it work? Did it confirm the splicing errors?
Mostly, no. It turned out to be quite challenging for FBN1. The problem is that FBN1 is expressed at very low levels in blood cells, which was the sample type available for most people in the 100 QDGP. Because there wasn't much FBN1 RNA to begin with, the RNA-seq didn't capture enough information. Across all 10 datasets, they found only a single RNA read that supported one of the predicted splicing events.
Wow, just one read. So RNA-seq wasn't the magic bullet here for validation.
Not from blood samples, no. It really highlights that the best validation method depends on the gene and the available tissue. Their main workhorse for validation was actually RT-PCR.
Right, reverse transcriptase PCR. Explain that again.
You take RNA from the patient's blood, convert it into a more stable DNA copy, ZDNA, and then use PCR primers designed specifically to amplify the region around the predicted splice defect. If abnormal splicing is happening, you'll see PCR products of unexpected sizes, which you can then sequence to confirm exactly what went wrong.
And was RT-PCR more successful?
Yes, much more so. Despite the low expression challenge, they managed to get informative results using RT-PCR from blood RNA for every case they attempted. 11 families used it as primary validation, plus 2 others for confirmation. It sometimes needed careful optimization, but it worked and was less resource-intensive than other methods. The main limitation was needing a fresh blood sample.
They also used something called minigene assays.
They did, for 3 families. A minigene assay is where you build a small artificial gene construct in the lab. It contains the exon and surrounding intron sequence from FBN1, both the normal version and the version with the patient's variant. You put these constructs into lab-grown cells, which then transcribe and splice the minigene.
And you compare the results from the normal versus the variant construct.
Exactly. If the variant construct produces abnormally spliced RNA compared to the normal one, it confirms the variant's effect on splicing. They use this for 3 families, and it confirmed the predictions in all 3. It's useful if you can't get patient RNA, but it takes more time and resources than RT-PCR, and designing the constructs can be tricky sometimes.
So adding it all up, how many of the 20 candidate variants got experimental confirmation?
They achieved experimental validation for 16 out of the 20 unique variants. 15 were confirmed in this study through RT-PCR or minigenes, and 1 recurrent variant had been previously confirmed and published by another group.
16 out of 20 validated. That's a pretty high success rate. It really backs up the idea that their computational approach was flagging real culprits.
It does. It shows that combining genome sequencing with careful in silico prediction and targeted experimental follow-up is a powerful strategy for finding these cryptic variants.
Okay, so they found them and validated many. But the paper goes into quite a bit of detail about interpreting the splice AI results, suggesting it's not always straightforward. It's more than just looking at that mean score.
Right. This is really important for getting it right clinically. Just taking the default splice AI delta score, which measures the change in predicted splicing caused by the variant at face value, isn't always enough for accurate interpretation or even for designing the validation experiments.
What kind of nuances did they find? They mentioned window size.
Yes. Splice AI, by default, looks for potential splice sites within a relatively small window around the variant, usually 50 base pairs. But these cryptic variants can sometimes activate or affect splice sites that are much further away. The researchers found that expanding the analysis window, say to 500 base pairs, sometimes gave a more accurate prediction.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Family 17 had a variant, C1837 plus 5GC. The standard 50 BP window predicted only a moderate effect. But when they looked further out, in a 500 BP window, Splice AI gave a very strong prediction for a new splice site being created about 60 base pairs away.
And did the lab work confirm that?
It did. RT-PCR showed that the exon was extended by 66 base pairs, consistent with that more distant site being activated. So if they had only looked at the default window prediction, they might have underestimated the variant's impact or struggled to design the right PCR primers to see the effect. Looking wider was key.
They also emphasized looking at absolute splice AI scores, not just the change, the delta score. Why is that important?
This is a bit more subtle. The delta score tells you how much the variant changes the score. But the absolute score tells you the inherent likelihood of a particular sequence being used as a splice site, whether it's the normal site or a potential cryptic one. Sometimes a cryptic site might already exist in the normal DNA and have a reasonably high absolute score, even if it's not usually used.
Okay.
Now, a variant might only increase that cryptic site score by a small amount, giving a low delta score. But if that small increase pushes the absolute score of the cryptic site higher than the absolute score of the nearby normal splice site, the cell's machinery might suddenly prefer the cryptic site.
Ah, so the variant just tips the balance even if the change itself wasn't huge.
Exactly. The example from family 23, C.4942 plus 19AT, showed this well. Low delta score, $0.2. But the variant pushed the absolute score of a nearby cryptic donor site from 0.79 up to 0.99, making it stronger than the normal site, which dropped slightly to 0.84.
And the functional result?
RT-PCR confirmed it caused a 13 base pair extension of the exon. This variant was previously considered likely benign, probably based on just the low delta score. Looking at the absolute scores revealed its true potential. It even helped them figure out what was going on in family 7, where initial experiments failed until they re-examined the absolute scores to design better primers.
So these deeper computational analyses are vital for correct interpretation and successful validation. It's not just plug and play.
Not at all. It requires careful examination to avoid misclassifying variants or missing effects. It really bridges the gap between finding something suspicious and understanding if it's truly pathogenic.
Let's shift to the consequences for the protein. You said 13 of the 20 variants were predicted to cause a loss of function, probably by creating premature stop codons.
Yes, that's the most common way FBN1 variants cause Marfan. It leads to haploinsufficiency, basically. Having only one working copy of the gene isn't enough to make the required amount of fibrillin-1 protein for healthy tissues. The faulty message often gets destroyed, or a useless shortened protein is made.
But what about the other 7 variants, the ones that didn't seem to create stop codons?
These are often trickier. They resulted in splicing changes predicted to keep the protein sequence in frame. That means they might insert extra amino acids from a pseudoexon, delete some amino acids from exon skipping or contraction, or affect non-coding regions. For these, just knowing the splice defect happened isn't always enough. You need to think about what those changes do to the protein structure or function.
So adding or removing a few amino acids might matter a lot, or maybe not.
Exactly. It depends where in the protein it happens. Is it in a critical structural part? Does it disrupt how the protein folds or interacts with other molecules? Some variants, like one causing a tiny 2 amino acid insertion, family 6, are really hard to predict without functional studies. Others involve larger in-frame insertions, families 11 and 19, or deletions, families 17, 18, which are more likely to be disruptive but still need careful assessment.
And there was that unusual one in the 5' UTR, the non-coding start region.
Yeah, family 9's variant, C182 plus 1GA. It affected the very first non-coding exon, extending it by just 4 DNA letters. But those 4 letters created a new AUG start codon before the real start codon for the FBN1 protein.
Creating an upstream open reading frame, a UORF, you said that can act like a decoy.
That's right. The cell's protein-making machinery might start translating at this fake start site, which can then interfere with it efficiently finding and using the real start site downstream. The hypothesis is that this reduces the overall amount of normal fibrillin-1 protein being made, even if the main coding sequence is okay.
That's a subtle way to cause disease, regulatory almost.
It is. And confirming that mechanism would need specific lab assays. But the family members had Marfan features and negative standard testing, making it a compelling candidate. These regulatory variants are definitely underappreciated.
Did any variant appear in multiple families?
Yes, one really stood out, C1589-through-wool-217-GT. They found this exact variant in 7 different people from 4 unrelated families in the UK.
Wow, a recurrent cryptic variant. Was its splice AI score high?
Interestingly, no. Its initial score was relatively low, 0.20, but the fact that it kept popping up independently in unrelated families with Marfan F-TOD was a huge red flag, suggesting it was truly pathogenic.
Did they check if the families might be distantly related, sharing an ancestor?
They did haplotype analysis, looking at the genetic background around the variant. The results suggested these families were not related recently. It seems this specific spot in the intron is just prone to this particular mutation occurring multiple times independently, a mutational hotspot.
So this highlights that even variants with lower prediction scores need attention if they recur in affected individuals.
Absolutely. Its recurrence, combined with a previous publication showing it creates a 202 base pair pseudoexon, makes it a clear pathogenic variant that labs should probably be specifically screening for, even though it's deep intronic.
Thinking about the overall impact for the patients, what percentage of these previously unsolved FTAD cases got an answer through this approach? What was the diagnostic yield?
Within this specific cohort of families in the 100 KGP who had FTAD features but no prior genetic diagnosis, finding these non-canonical splice variants solved the case for about 2.8% to 3.3% of them, depending on the analysis set.
Around 3%. That might not sound massive, but for those individual families after years on that diagnostic odyssey, it's everything.
It really is. These were families who'd often had multiple rounds of testing gene panels, exomes that came back negative. Finding the specific FBN1 splice variant was the breakthrough.
And clinically, did these families have classic Marfan features?
It was a spectrum, which is typical for Marfan. They had various combinations of the skeletal signs, eye problems like lens dislocation, and critically, the aortic involvement. Aortic root size varied quite a bit from near normal in some younger relatives to requiring major surgery in others.
And the power of getting that specific genetic diagnosis is cascade testing, right?
Yes, that's a major benefit. Once you know the exact variant causing the condition in one person, you can efficiently test their relatives, parents, siblings, children. Those who inherited the variant can then get proactive cardiac surveillance, monitoring their aorta, maybe starting medications, planning interventions if needed. Those who didn't inherit it can be reassured. It directly guides potentially life-saving management. The paper even shows pedigrees illustrating this impact.
How did these variants end up being classified clinically? Pathogenic? Uncertain.
Using the standard ACM-GMP guidelines, adapted by the Klingon Expert Panel for Splicing, they classified 9 of the 20 unique variants as pathogenic, 5 as likely pathogenic, and 6 remained as variants of uncertain significance, VUS. Of course, VUS classifications can sometimes be upgraded later if more evidence emerges.
Now, the study also tried to replicate this in the huge UK Biobank dataset. How did that go?
Right. UK Biobank has genetic data on almost 500,000 people, linked to health records via diagnostic codes like ICD-10. They looked for participants coded with aortic aneurysm dissection, I71, or specifically Marfan syndrome, Q87.4.
Did they see the same enrichment of these predicted FBN1 splice variants in the aortic group, I71, as they saw in the 100 kilogp FTAID cohort?
Interestingly, no. In the broad I71 group in UK Biobank, there was no significant enrichment. They found some rare predicted splice variants, but they weren't statistically more common in people with that code compared to the rest of the biobank population.
Why the difference?
The likely reason is phenotype specificity. The I71 code is very broad. It includes abdominal aortic aneurysms, which are much more common than thoracic ones, and usually related to things like smoking and high blood pressure, not typically single FBN1 variants. The 100 kilogp cohort was specifically enriched for familial thoracic disease, a much better fit for FBN1 involvement. The UKB I71 group was just too diluted with other causes.
But what about the UKB participants coded specifically with Marfan syndrome, Q87.4?
There they did see a very strong enrichment. The predicted splice variants were significantly more common in that group, with a huge odds ratio, similar to the 100 D2GP findings.
So that confirms it, then?
It supports it, but with a significant caveat the authors mention. It's quite possible that many people got the Q87.4 code because they'd already had clinical genetic testing that found an FBN1 variant, maybe even one of these splice variants. So finding the variant again in the UKB data for someone already diagnosed based on that variant isn't truly independent confirmation. It could be circular reasoning.
I see. So the UKB results support the link in clinically diagnosed Marfan, but the broad aortic code wasn't specific enough. It really highlights how crucial detailed clinical information is.
Absolutely. You need good phenotyping, even with massive data sets.
Okay, let's pull back and synthesize. What are the big takeaways from this study by Walker and colleagues?
The clearest message is that these non-canonical splice variants, the ones hiding deep in the introns, are a real and probably underdiagnosed cause of Marfan and related aortic disease. They're not just theoretical. They explain about 3% of previously unsolved cases in this well-defined cohort.
And finding them requires whole genome sequencing.
Yes, that's the enabling technology because it reads the introns. Standard exon sequencing or panels will miss them.
But the sequence alone isn't enough. You need the whole package.
Exactly. You need the genome sequence data. You need sophisticated prediction tools like Splice AI, used intelligently considering things like analysis windows and absolute scores. And then, crucially, you need experimental RNA validation to prove the predicted splicing defect actually occurs in the patient's cells. It's a multi-step process.
What does this mean for clinical genetic testing for Marfan going forward?
The authors strongly suggest that testing should incorporate analysis of introns, looking beyond the standard splice boundaries. And when candidate splice variants are found, labs need pathways for confirmatory RNA testing.
What are the roadblocks to making that standard practice everywhere?
There are definitely challenges. Clinically validated pipelines for analyzing introns systematically aren't universal yet. And setting up reliable clinical-grade RNA testing, especially for low-expression genes like FBN1 from blood, requires specific expertise, resources, and sample handling protocols that many labs might not have readily available. It's a significant logistical hurdle.
How might this influence the official guidelines for classifying these variants?
The paper touches on the Klingon FBN1 guidelines. While they cover standard splice variants well, they could be clearer or perhaps stronger regarding evidence from experimentally confirmed deep intronic splicing events, like pseudo-exon inclusion or complex in-frame changes. Strengthening criteria like PVS1 for demonstrated aberrant splicing could help resolve more VUS classifications.
Which would provide more clarity for patients and doctors.
Exactly. Reducing the VUS rate is a major goal in clinical genetics.
And the value of these large-scale projects, like a 100-kill EGP,
immense for discovery. They allow systematic searches and provide the statistical power to find these enrichments. They also fuel tool development. But as the UK Biobank comparison showed, the richness and accuracy of the clinical data linked to the genomes is paramount. Garbage in, garbage out still applies, even with big data.
Let's circle back to that RNA validation bottleneck. It really seems key.
It is. The low FBN1 expression in blood is a persistent challenge. RT-PCR worked here with effort, but sometimes other approaches like using skin fibroblasts or perhaps even novel methods might be needed. The difficulty in getting robust validation definitely contributes to diagnostic delays and uncertainty for some families.
And getting that validation is especially important because FBN1 variants can be found incidentally, right? It's on the secondary findings list.
That's a very important point. If you find one of these cryptic variants by chance when sequencing for something else, you need strong proof it's actually damaging before reporting it back and potentially causing unnecessary worry or interventions. RNA evidence provides that crucial functional support.
Do you think the prediction tools will get so good eventually that we won't need as much lab work?
They're constantly improving. Splice AI is a huge leap over older tools. Future AI might become even more accurate, maybe incorporating gene-specific knowledge. Perhaps computational evidence could contribute more weight in classification, reducing the need for wet lab work for some variant types, but completely replacing experimental validation, especially for complex or novel splicing patterns. I think that's unlikely anytime soon, given the biological complexity.
Any other interesting tidbits?
They mentioned that for some genes, these deep intronic variants that cause pseudoexons seem to cluster in certain areas, perhaps because the underlying sequence is already somewhat primed to be recognized as an exon if a mutation occurs nearby. Understanding that could refine searches too.
So overall, this paper is a fantastic case study in pushing the boundaries of genetic diagnosis.
It really is. It shows that for a condition we thought we understood reasonably well, like Marfan, looking deeper into the genome with the right combination of sequencing, computational analysis, and lab work can still yield crucial answers for families waiting years for a diagnosis.
Well, it's complex, demanding work, but the payoff in ending that diagnostic odyssey and enabling better care is just enormous.
Absolutely. Providing certainty, allowing proactive family screening it, can literally save lives by managing the aortic risk effectively.
Which leaves us with a really provocative thought. If these cryptic variants are causing 3% of unexplained Marfan-Ptade, how many other genetic conditions currently listed as unsolved have their answers lurking in the introns or other non-coding regions, just waiting for us to apply these kinds of comprehensive approaches?
That's the big question driving a lot of genomics research right now. This study provides a compelling glimpse of what might be hiding in plain sight, if only we look in the right way.
A fascinating area. This exploration was based on the open access article titled Utility of Genome Sequencing and Group Enrichment to Support Splice Variant Interpretation in Marfan Syndrome by Susan Walker and colleagues, published in Genetics and Medicine in 2025. It's available under a CC BY 4.0 license.
And you can find the DOI and a link to that license right in the description for this session so you can check out the original paper for yourselves.
Thanks for joining us for Base by Base. We'll be back soon to explore another piece of complex science. Thank you.